Good morning, and you're very welcome into the second hour of today's show. If you've just joined us, where have you been? You missed an interesting first hour, and many of you commenting in off the back of listening to that. Read the city initiatives. Accommodation in a city is the death of business. Is that really the way we want to go? I mean, obviously, if the accommodation replaces businesses, evidently, it is the death of that business. But this is not about sort of incentivizing businesses to switch to residential property. But the more people you have in a city, the more vibrant you have a nighttime economy as well. You would note cafes staying open later, pubs being busier, restaurants being busier. So I wouldn't agree with you. Obviously, if the accommodation is replacing businesses, you're 100% correct. But I think a good mix, you know, you see cities empty out, certain places empty out, and there's nothing going on, like nothing going on. It's crazy sometimes. So I think a balance is good, but you may well be right too. A caller asks, why were so many people informers within the IRA? Why were there so many from the top to the bottom? Well, in any conflict, dispute, warfare, whatever way you want to describe it, there are always people that switch. They did it in World War II. They're doing it right now in Ukraine, where Russians are being accused of helping Ukrainians and vice versa. It's always been a case. What are the regulations for defective concrete block houses, and where are the defective materials going once the house is demolished? I know of some contractors who are actually burying the materials. Well, that's not allowed. There is specific regulative routes that I'm not sure if it's allowed. I don't know if burying it's allowed. Sorry, I shouldn't say that as if I know it. I don't know. I would have thought it wouldn't be allowed because there are specific regulatory routes. It's not as bad as... I don't think, in terms of public health, it's not as bad as like asbestos, but it's in the same space in terms of how you have to dispose of it. And I know the council or the state, I can't remember, maybe it was the council, put out tenders for companies to actually deal with this waste specifically. But I know there are people very much in the know in that regard, and they'll put me right as to whether or not you can bury it. I presume you can't, and how you go about getting rid of it effectively. On the issue of recycling, I've noticed a large number of business people taking people's return cans and bringing them back to the return scheme. Are they donating this money to charity or simply pocketing it? I'm trying to figure out what's happening there. How are businesses getting their hands... Oh, right. Okay, I get where you're coming from. So in other words, if you're in a restaurant and you get a can of Coke, they're retaining the can and you're wondering what's happening with the 15 cent. Well, you'd have to be sure that the additional 15 cent in that scenario had actually been applied to the cost already, right? So we are charged the 15 cent, but if we're not charged the 15 cent, I suppose the company can do with the cans whatever they wish to do. There is a recycling centre in Dunloe. Great service, no excuses. Yes, and I've had reason to use the recycling service in Milford. Lovely lads working in there. And equally down in Lahey, I've used that place as well. There are the experiences of two recycling centres, and they couldn't be more helpful. Actually, you know, particularly friendly, which is nice. Name and shame the polluters. In France, they put names and photos of the people in the papers and on social media. Only shaming them will make them stop. I'm not sure there's much point in putting things in the papers anymore, but certainly social media, name and shame. But sometimes people don't have any shame, and if they're from outside the state, in some cases, maybe they don't care. A caller says, I bet money the bottles and cans are from Northern Ireland, therefore no return scheme, and they don't want to pay to bin them properly. Well, you don't have to pay, you see. You can go to the... These people, if a dump was open 24 hours a day and was twice the distance away from this road in Dookery, they'd still go up to the road in Dookery and dump them. I'm not contradicting the councillor, but he's got more faith in people than I am. On road safety, Greg, I've noticed a huge increase in the number of students getting off secondary school buses and walking straight out in front of you to cross the road. Surely, at this age, they should know better. Unfortunately, I come across quite a bit of that myself. Great work on your coverage of social media, the dirty war in the north, etc. For your information, you can pause your VPN too so that it will not reduce algorithms. I know where you're coming from, but it's still... just by the way, in relation to age checks in Britain, just to give you some stats, the UK effectively. So they introduced age checks this year. And a well-known adult site, beginning with a P, Its visits from the UK decreased by 77% when compared to July of 2025 following the introduction of age verification laws. So is that effectively stopping young boys and girls going onto this P-Hub website? Or is that adults desisting from going on it because they don't want to have to provide ID? Generally speaking, visits to adult sites reduced by a third. Maybe it's no harm. Adults are visiting them less as well, or maybe they're getting them somewhere else. So there you go. We don't know if the 77% reduction of adult site visitors were minors. We don't know that because they could be adults as well. But as I say, one third of the UK's viewers of adult sites in general were under 18. So that would indicate perhaps maybe. So like under 18 shouldn't be on these sites polluting their young minds, should they? There can be never be an argument for that. But as I say, VPNs can be used. But you really have to have a real interest in that stuff to start fiddling with the VPNs. And I'm not sure everyone has. What the government is doing is too little too late, believes the listener. The phones should have eye recognition so that they can't watch whatever they want until they're 18. Once they're 18, they can access whatever they want. Until this is done, there's no way around this. Phones have ruined a whole generation. And I just want to mention more messages coming in that regard as well, but I'll get to them a little later because we have the bingo numbers coming. Good morning, Greg. There's a coffee morning in the Red Door Farm today from 10:30, so it's kicking off in 12 minutes, until 1 p.m. It's all in aid of the Residence Comfort Fund at the Nazareth House. So if you want to get along for a nice cup of coffee or tea, maybe some tray bakes, get along to the Red Door in Farm until 1 p.m. this day. And you'll be supporting the event and in turn supporting the Residence Comfort Fund at Nazareth House, which is really significant because it makes people's lives all the more enjoyable. We're joined on the programme now by Andrew Brownlee, who's CEO of the Construction Industry Federation. Thank you so much for joining us and a very good morning to you.
Good morning.
Right, you are in the county to meet CIF's members, construction companies from the region, and a lot to discuss for a lot of different reasons. Quite interesting to read a statistic: 62% of Ireland's leading contractors are scaling up operations abroad, which is problematic, isn't it? Especially given the government's very ambitious housing delivery expectations.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is. And look, I think there's no doubt at the moment that we're in a kind of national housing and an infrastructure emergency. You'd have seen a whole range of kind of policy initiatives in order to try and stimulate housing supply in recent months. And last week, you obviously had the Accelerating Infrastructure Task Force report, which is really about trying to address the infrastructure blockages that are stopping housing from being developed and also our infrastructure from being put in place to sustain communities. And look, I think it is a really significant issue. It is a really significant issue for Donegal and for the North West. If you look at the IMD World Competitiveness Rankings, like, Ireland is ranked as the most competitive economy in Europe, but on basic infrastructure, it's 44th out of 69 developed economies. And if you go further than that and you look at the actual North and West region, there's some great work by the Northern Western Regional Assembly on this, actually. The North West region is actually ranked at 218 out of 234 regions across Europe. So we have a major infrastructure deficit here, and we need to find ways to unblock the water, the energy, the transport infrastructure in order to start to grow our housing supply.
So, Andrew, in relation to the conversation you'll be having tonight, is it on housing and major infrastructural development, or is the focus more on infrastructural development?
Yeah, I mean, I think the beauty of the Construction Industry Federation, I'm 2 months into the job as CEO now, is like we represent everyone across the industry, from the smallest companies, one to employee companies to the largest kind of international contractors. And so what you find when you go and meet the different branches is the dynamics are completely different, and there's so many different issues and opportunities that to talk about. So I think infrastructure is really good, really important from a Donegal perspective, because you know there is a regional imbalance there. You know, it's great to hear the NDP talk about 275 billion, but we really need to see those plans address the real infrastructure deficit that's in the Northwest. So I mean that includes things like, you know, looking at extending the Western Rail Corridor into Sligo, Donegal and up to Derry. It's about fast tracking the TEN-T road project, you know, between Letterkenny, Manor Cunningham, Lifford, Ballybuffet and Orla bypass. Like they're the types of things we need to see fast
Is it a case that we have to be careful that we, by the time, say, for instance, the TEN-T project, I think that's more likely to ever come to fruition than a Western Rail Corridor, unfortunately. But is it the case that we could find ourselves, you know, with slim pickings in terms of companies that are capable of taking on such a project? Because, you know, I don't think there's any major, there's no projects of that scale, as far as I'm aware, currently in planning across the country in that window. Now, my information could be wrong in relation to that, but that's my understanding, right? So these companies aren't going to sit in their backsides. They're going to look to where there's some certainty in 29, 30, 31, 32, 33. So I'm wondering, could we find ourselves then with, you know, paying more because how many bidders can come in and actually deliver that project, especially with the optimism of maybe having all three strands of it beginning at the same time? That's only big companies can do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we would stress, and obviously we represent the industry, but we very much believe that the industry has the capacity to deliver. I think you mentioned at the top of the item, like our main contractors are actually growing their overseas business at around about 3-4 times the rate that they're growing the domestic business. And that's at a time when, as I've said, we have a national housing and infrastructure emergency. So if we're clear about when these projects are happening, where they're happening, when they're being tendered, when they're going to commence, when they're going to complete, and how much investment is going to be involved, then our industry will be able to have the workforce ready, have the capacity ready to deliver. But it really is about that certainty. It really is about turning the NDP, the task force report, into a tangible pipeline of concrete projects that will allow our employers to kind of ramp up and be ready.
Is it possible, though, that maybe some of your members hold all the cards, to quote Donald Trump, which I never thought I might? In that, you know, we saw a situation where there were, what, 40, 50, 60,000 planning permissions that were granted for projects around the capital. They were sat on. And then the government in the budget came in with incentives to trying to get them going. You know, is there a bit of that gaming going on, that the industry is big, but it's also such that really you can leverage the government and effectively us, you know, just to drive profits?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the first point to make is, you know, our members operate in the private sector. They have to generate enough income to wash their faces. Otherwise, you know, they wouldn't survive. Their shareholders would not support them. So, like, there is a need for projects to stack up commercially. And the stark truth has been, particularly around Dublin, that there, you know, the development of apartments, the development of new homes in many cases has not been viable over the last few years. We've been relying on the Land Development Authority, the approved housing bodies to develop effectively all of the apartment stock in particular. So we had to move the dial. We had to introduce, you know, things like rent pressure zone changes, apartment design standards, the VAT reduction, to actually make the business case viable for our home builders and our contractors to invest in the area. Because like there's a complete lack of private investment at the moment, and we need to bring that back into the equation if we're to have any hope of delivering the 300,000 houses by 2030.
In relation to that, what role, if any, do your members have in the delivery of water and power infrastructure? Because, you know, if we're completely honest, in terms of the scale of delivery, that can only come when we've got sewers, when we've got water, when we've got power. So do your members of the Federation have much of a role in the infrastructural delivery at that level? And if you don't, that's a problem too, because that has to be costed and timelined before you can even begin to start timelining some of these major projects and not so major projects.
Yeah, I mean, our members are absolutely at the heart of those infrastructure development projects. When I talk about certainty, I mean, what is really key is the is knowing when these water, these energy, these transport projects are going to happen. So it's really, really important that we understand that kind of concrete project pipeline. I mean, there's a kind of stark fact set out in that Accelerating Infrastructure report last week that the development cycle for our utilities projects is now around twice as long as it was 20 years ago. You know, so like we have to unblock the infrastructure development challenges that exist at the moment. I think there's encouraging signs. The Housing Activation Unit is specifically looking at sites where you can unlock housing supply within a relatively short time frame with one piece of infrastructure. So that might be a link road, that might be a bit of wastewater infrastructure, it might be ESB connectivity. And so there's a real focus on kind of where we can ramp up housing supply in the short term. And then hopefully this task force report will really start to address the major critical infrastructure blockages over the next few years. And I mean, they're talking about things like legislating for critical national infrastructure projects. They're talking about...
They were doing that. I remember having that conversation 15, 16 years ago about an interconnector for Donegal, talking about new schemes that would... You couldn't oppose certain developments that were seen to be in the national interest or whatever it might be. But I don't know if that, anything ever came of that. Andrew, just, you might not have the figure in front of you. There's different figures bandied about as to the workforce, you know, how many feet can get on the ground, how many bums can get into the excavators, etc. I've heard some figures like there's a 70,000-80,000 shortfall in construction workers that would be required to deliver some of the stuff we're talking about from within the industry. Is there a workforce shortage? And if so, you know, what's the figure being talked about?
No, I mean, I don't believe so. We have 179,000 people working in the construction industry.
So where do these talk of, where do these, you know, these figures of 70,000 or 80,000 short, where do they come from then? Maybe you don't know. I'm just curious. You've heard them yourself.
Well, there is analysis out there that kind of looks at the extent of the infrastructure, the housing development required, and kind of projects that over the existing labour force. But I suppose I would make the point that our industry is changing by the day. You know, the adoption of modern methods of construction, different ways of building, different ways of construction, different ways of managing projects, that all plays into a different skill set that we're going to require moving forward. I mean, I came from Solus, which was the national kind of further education and training and apprenticeship agency. So I have a bit of insight into this. And, you know, there's kind of a default assumption that, you know, if you're doubling the number of homes you want to build, you need to double the number of apprenticeships.
Not true. No, of course not.
That's just not true. There are so many diverse and new skills that our industry requires. We do need to get more people into the construction industry. We need to get more young people interested. We need to convince them that it's not a job that necessarily means you're out on site all day. There's so many different roles that you can take on in the industry now. So we need to get more people in. We need to get more people back to Ireland. I think there's a stat that up to 4,900 Irish construction workers emigrate each year to go and work elsewhere. So we need to get them back in the country. But I think if we do that, you know, we have the capacity to ramp up. Such an exciting industry with so many opportunities now. And it's just about, you know, building the momentum, supporting our members and our employers, and having a real clear idea about when these projects are happening, and we'll be ready to deliver.
And finally, maybe you touched on it, are there Northwest Donegal specific conversations you're anticipating, in this meeting?
Yeah, I mean, going back to that point, so, I mean, obviously there's particular infrastructure challenges for Donegal, and, you know, there is a deficit there. You know, there, you know, that stat about how far behind the curve it is when you look at kind of other European regions, I think that's really important. I mean, the other issue that I'm sure will be no surprise to you is, you know, you're obviously on the border. So there are, you know, issues around, you know, contractors in Northern Ireland, you know, competing fairly for business. There are issues around, you obviously have a very regional workforce. So issues around things like, you know, country money and tax treatment of employees who by necessity have to be very mobile in our industry. You know, there's obviously the zoning of land at local authority level. So everywhere, every branch meeting I've been to so far has its own kind of unique kind of perspectives and issues that they want the CIF to address. And I'm sure tonight will be no different. And, you know, I think some of those things will certainly be raised.
All right, Andrew, thanks for all your time. Look after yourself. Andrew Brownlee, CEO of the Construction Industry Federation. Now, research from the National Cancer Registry Ireland shows diagnoses of cancer dropped by almost a third at the start of COVID, but numbers returned to normal by 22. Survival rates for 2020 and 21 were remained in line with previous years, this despite the pandemic's impact on health services. Professor Deirdre Murray is Director of the National Cancer Registry in Ireland. Good morning, Deirdre. Thank you very much for your time.
Good morning, Greg.
Were you surprised to learn that there is no clear evidence of lasting harm to early survival or mortality even during those COVID years?
Well, I suppose when we do think back to 2020, there was a lot of concern that people were going to present late with their cancers progress further than usual, and that people undergoing treatment services would have their treatments disrupted, and that would impact on their outcomes. But I suppose what we have found is that there was no consistent rise in the number of late diagnoses. So although there was a reduction in 2020, it was predominantly in patients who had very early diagnosis who have maybe a little bit more time to be picked up. So that kind of was very reassuring. And it's also encouraging to see, I mean, this is only early stage diagnosis. It's only the one-year diagnosis, one-year survival. That one-year survival was stable for those diagnosed in 2020 and 2021 compared to previous years.
And how could that be with, I think maybe you touched on this to some extent because people maybe had more time, but a pause in the screening programmes, the difficulties in getting actually into the GP's office, which can often be the first port of call. Do we understand why that didn't lead to any data changes?
Well, I suppose, you know, GP visits were virtual rather than being in person. And then, of course, we have to remember things like private hospitals were commissioned to look after non-COVID cases. And as well as that, GPs had enhanced direct access to diagnostics, you know, whereas before they used to have to go through hospital services, they had direct access to diagnostics. So those all most likely helped. As well as that, there was a lot of work done nationally to improve patient pathways, to kind of tweak guidelines to keep patients away from the acute services as much as possible, at the same time keeping their treatment schedules, you know, as close to what had been planned. So it was, you know, there was a huge effort from both public and private healthcare providers and, you know, wrapped around really cancer patients. And we were seeing, you know, early signs that it was effective.
Obviously, some of those elements aren't sustainable, but there are enhancements there. Do we continue to employ those enhancements? And is there any learnings that could actually maybe see us, you know, reduce deaths from cancer from what we've learned at what we can do in difficult times like COVID?
Well, I suppose that the mechanisms that were put in place, as we said, so far have seemed to work. Now, the Cancer Registry is the national repository for cancer data, and we've been monitoring cancer patients for 30 years, and we'll continue to monitor this cohort for, you know, 5 years and 10 years past diagnosis. And we might see some late or delayed effects then, but, you know, the fact that we didn't see it at 1 year, and particularly for some of those time-sensitive cancers, such as lung cancer, when we didn't see delayed effects in 1 year, that is positive in terms of cancer services. You know, it's hard to know, you know, to divide out of which of all the various mechanisms and interventions that were put in was most successful. Mm. But there's no doubt about it that kind of unprecedented public and private working together to, you know, to counter COVID and protect cancer patients, you know, was successful from the data to date.
Okay, thank you so much for your time, Professor Deirdre Murray, Director of the National Cancer Registry in Ireland. Right, we had this correspondence from a listener, and it reads as follows. Hi, Greg. I know everyone is full of excitement for Christmas, but personally, I'm dreading it. Why? Well, my husband's parents will arrive the week before Christmas and make themselves at home until the second week in January. In that time, I'll be chief cook and bottle washer. They wouldn't be so bad if his mother wasn't the most unkind woman in the world. Constant remarks about our two girls' behaviour, who really are the quietest best girls ever. I've asked my husband to tell them that we've plans this year and will not be here. But no, he wants to keep the peace and keep saying ignore her. It's getting harder and harder since he won't say it. I'm trying to pick up the courage to say it. My question is, do I do it via phone call or text message? How have others handled it? If we didn't have Santa arriving, I'd book Spain. Well, you can't book Spain because Santa is arriving. So what do you do in this situation? Mom and Dad, I think they're really overstaying the welcome there, to be honest with you. And I loved my parents a day or two more than enough. But they're staying for effectively 3 weeks, a week before Christmas and into the second week of January. The woman of the house is chief cook and bottle washer. What would be particularly annoying is the constant commentary on her girls' behaviour. We're very defensive and she knows her girls are good, and it's difficult if you've got someone that, and especially over that period of time, might influence them or their confidence for that matter. The husband, who I think has the major role in this because it's his parents, seems to not want to get involved and doesn't want to upset the peace. That is the problem for me. The caller's completely skipped over that and gone straight to how does she handle it. Firstly, I would say that you need to say to your husband that, look, I love your parents, but it's too long. It's a special time of the year. It's a family time. And at some point, it has to be our time. And you love having the parents over, but it's just too long. I wouldn't get into the labour side of it, cooking and cleaning, and or even actually, I wouldn't even get in necessarily to the treatment of the two girls. It's just too long. I think it's just too blooming long. And I don't think really it should be you that has to say it to them. But maybe you know that your husband won't, and you're taking matters into your own hand. How do you say it? What do you say? 086 60 25000. Have you ever had to deal with this? 086 60 25000, or give us a call on 074 91 25000. Right, some of your comments on this on social media, because we popped it up on our socials in advance of talking about it. Now, my advice would be to let them come and or ignore her as much as possible, but when she mentions your children or complains, be ready to defend them. Have your replies ready, short and to the point. Just say a little, but in words that she knows you will not see your children being bullied, because that's what she's doing. I feel your pain, but can understand your husband wanting to keep the peace. Say little, but be sure she knows you mean it. set down a few rules in the beginning on how it's going to be. Best holiday ever, and happiness and niceness is the theme. Good luck. Be ready. The problem is it could just very much be that person's personality, and it's very hard to change that person's personality. Another, God forgive me, but even parents-in-law should know when to come and when to leave. Your husband needs to stand up and be the man. Tell them in the nice way that they are welcome for Christmas dinner and a two-day stay, but it's time for your family, for your husband and kids to rest, rewind and reconnect, not jump around. Parents-in-law, I agree with you. That's Victoria that made that comment. Yeah, that to me is the common sense thing, and I do really think it's down to the... It's down to the husband. It's too long, and it is a time for bonding and getting together, and you don't want to go back to work exhausted, or when the house clears, working from at home or in the home exhausted. It's too blooming long. Let's know. I'll bring you some more social media comments in relation to that as the morning wears on, and we want your radio comments on it. 086 60 25000. And we just have to understand that we have to factor in that maybe the mother-in-law is jealous of the wife's relationship with her son. That happens. Let's not pretend it doesn't happen. That she could be really quite contrary, that she might not even like the daughter. Maybe she doesn't feel she's up to scratch. I'm not saying that's the case, but we have to factor that in giving advice. This could be the 3 weeks of the year where she can really make this girl's life a misery. You just don't know. Personally, 2 days, and then I would lie and say we are moving. We're not going to Spain. We're going down the country. Or we've got day trips planned for the kids or something. And be prepared to almost fall out over the head of it. That's what I'd do anyway. We are joined on the programme now by Dr. Dunio Murphy, Miola Murphy, I beg your pardon. Good morning to you.
And good morning, Greg, and good morning to your listeners.
Thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Murphy is an ED consultant and board member of the Women of the World programme. Cheryl Davis is president of the Women of the World programme in Donegal. Good morning to you, Cheryl.
Good morning, Greg, and good morning to your listeners as well.
It's great to have you with us. Right, so what's the focus of the annual Intercultural Women's Seminar? I don't know which one of you want to take that.
Just yeah, I'll talk about that. So the Women's Seminar is very much it's an annual forum for women to come together and talk about issues that affect women, not just local women, but migrant women, because those issues affect women differently. So we do this every year, usually around November. We're going to be holding one this year on Thursday, tomorrow, actually, on the 11th of November. And the theme this year, it's going to reflect the issues going on now. The theme is exploring diversity, opportunity, and challenges for inclusion.
Yeah, and there are lots of challenges, and there is sort of and they're interwoven, whether it's gender, ethnicity, interculturalism, racism. You know, all women are going to be touched, I think, unless you're very lucky, by some form of issues in those areas, Cheryl.
Yes, definitely. There's a lot of issue, and it's very hard when you don't know where to go, especially when you just come into the country. You don't have a clue what the informations are, where the informations are, where the right people are to talk to and stuff like that. So we're there to put, just to highlight these information and to get the words out there so women feel a sense of calm, you know, when they come to us. You know, just to have a conversation.
I presume it's also a nice space, is it, for women from all different backgrounds to come together?
Definitely it is. And, you know, what we tend to do as well, we tend to let them feel relaxed in the sense that, you know, it doesn't matter where you're from, you're always welcome. You know, come to the table and let's talk about what is affecting you. And then we will be there to help you. If we don't have the answers, we'll go and find it out.
Dr. Dunio, to lots of guest speakers.
Lots of guest speakers. There's an amazing panel of women from different parts that address women issues. We've got somebody from migrant women and health, specifically to talk about health issues affecting women. We've got somebody from the DLDC addressing issues around employment and opportunity for women. We'll be challenging issues on gender-based violence, specifically how it affects women. And we'll be talking about migrant women and education. So a broad panel of issues, and we're hoping to identify key issues that women women feel affected by mostly, and we're going to be identifying issues to tackle actively in 2026.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because, you know, it would still have value as a talking shop, and I don't mean that in a derogative way, but you want something to come from this as well, whether it's at health board, council or government level, you know, because you're doing great job in identifying this stuff, right? Mm. But we can't just know what's happening, right? We have to sort of figure out how we address it.
Absolutely. There's active participation. The way we actually do it every year, and it'll be similar this year as well. It's not just a bunch of speakers talking at women. Mm. We're talking to women. Women are participating. And afterwards, we break out into breakout sessions where we actually highlight issues that women may want to talk about so that everybody has their voice heard. And that's usually how we operate. And we actually take back these voices and suggestions to the office and formulate proper plans for the year.
Yeah, and it's all about women empowering women. It's the annual intercultural seminar on Thursday, the 11th of December. It's at the Trinity Hall, Ard O'Donnell in Letterkenny. And registration is essential. Booking is essential because places are limited. And we have those details here if you wish to go along. There's also a fashion show on the 18th, Cheryl. Talk to me about that.
Yes, we will have a fashion show on the 18th in the Radisson Blue Hotel. And that fashion show, it don't just look at a specific demographic of women. It takes in everybody. So everyone can come in and shine. It doesn't matter where you're from. You come in, enjoy, and just have a great time. And just share your culture. You know, it's amazing how you could look at a culture from a different perspective in the way they present and the things they do within their culture, you know. And so it eases people in terms of when you see a person, because normally we judge just by looking, but if you get to see how they respond and what they do in a daily basis, you can understand how they live.
But it sounds like also a nice opportunity to dress up.
Oh, it is. You know what I mean?
In cultural or cultural traditional clothing, you know what I mean? Whereby you might feel there aren't too many occasions in which you can do so. We all love a bit of dress up, don't we?
And I think it also gives women an opportunity to put on clothes that they wouldn't put on normally.
That's what I mean.
There's so much pride and
well, take
excitement.
Them off.
Well,
I mean the cardigans and the jumpers, right? I don't mean anything.
This is a family show, Greg.
No, doctor, do not paint me into that corner. I didn't mean it like that, right? And it's so important, isn't it, that we are not siloed, that the more we understand and learn about each other and our common problems, the better it is, isn't it, Doctor?
Absolutely. We want to emphasize that both the fashion show and the annual conference, they're actually part of the Peace Plus project for creative minorities. It's an active project that's actually meant to introduce interculturalism, multiculturalism, because a lot of our communities have been accused of just maybe involving migrant women. We're saying not just migrant women, we want local women, we want women from Ireland, women from diverse communities, because it's the only way we're going to start integrating and getting people to ask those questions about each other so that we ease.
So many opinions are formed by a lack of understanding. And that's not even intercultural. That's in many areas of life. Yeah. So it is an interesting day. There's a bit of food as well. It is it's the annual intercultural seminar. It's Thursday, the 11th of December in the Trinity Hall. Mm-hmm. It kicks off at 9:30 with registration and conversation and runs then right through to a light halal multi-ethnic lunch to be served at 1 p.m, right?
That's
so
it, yeah.
If you want to book, get on to donegallip@gmail.com. We also have telephone numbers here for you as well. And just to keep a note for your diary, when's the start time for the fashion show on Thursday, the 18th of December in the Radisson? Cheryl, I think you have that flyer, don't you?
I do have the flyer here, and the start time will be about 6 o'clock.
6 p.m., yeah.
Right, we come in at 6 o'clock and set up and, you know, just look gorgeous, take our pictures first and stuff, and then we knock it all off by 6:37.
Yeah, I think there'll be a lot of selfies taken that night.
Oh, I'm telling you. You know, just before Christmas, all the dolls and the glams are going to come out. So oh, definitely loads of
sounds
pictures.
Like a really fun night out. Okay. Right, so that's two dates for your diary. Get along to the annual intercultural seminar. That's in the Trinity Hall on Thursday the 11th, the following week. Then the 18th, it's the fashion show in the Radisson Hotel, Letterkenny. Dr. Dunau Miola Murphy.
Danielle Moulin Murphy, thank you.
I feel like we're saying it the same way, but maybe I'm not. An ED consultant, keep up your great work down there, by the way. Cheryl Davies, President of the Women of the World Programme in Donegal. Lovely to see both of you. Thank you so much for calling in and two very
important
just
before
events.
We even knock off, because even with the fashion show, we're just going to highlight as well, you know, with the Hurricane Melissa there. So proceeds well will go, you know, any donations at all will go towards that as well. So just to let everybody know, because, you know, that's going to be an ongoing process right up
exactly
through.
So it's for a good cause.
It is
as
for
well
a definitely
as,
good cause.
A good night out, of course, right?
Okay. Definitely.
That's the best way to do it. Thank you so much, both of you. We'll be back with the news, which we would just a couple of minutes late, so stay tuned.